To our next case, United States v. Williams. Mr. Stiller.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My client, Kevin Williams, calls upon this panel to attempt to reconcile some reasoning from this Court's decision this spring in Goodwin with the holding in 1993 in a case called United States v. Dedato. This spring in Goodwin, a panel made clear that a court, in fashioning special conditions of supervised release, is to be mindful of the rehabilitative objectives of supervision and to provide some degree of explanation. I think the inference to be drawn from those two points in Goodwin is that when a court fashions a condition of supervised release, it has to do so with rehabilitative objectives in mind and explain how that condition, as applied to this offender and this offense, serves some rehabilitative purpose. That's the reasoning of Goodwin. Dedato is very different. Read at its face, Dedato essentially said that while courts cannot impose costs of investigation upon a defendant as restitution, they can fashion it as a condition of supervised release. And so in the 20 years since Dedato, it's sort of become the law of this circuit that in a case involving buy money, repayment of that buy money is an appropriate condition of supervised release. But as in this case, Kevin Williams' case, there's absolutely no discussion in the record as to how requiring Mr. Williams to repay this buy money serves any objective, rehabilitative objective.
Mr. Stiller?
Yes.
In this case, on any count of conviction, the defendant could have been fined up to $250,000?
Subject to his ability to pay, yes.
And the guideline range would have been $3,000 to $30,000?
I don't disagree.
Okay. If we were to agree with you on the supervised release point, why wouldn't a district judge be entitled to simply structure this as a fine or take it into account, take the buy money into account in setting the fine, and as frankly as I used to do, say it's payable immediately. But if you can't pay it immediately, you'll pay while you're in prison and pay more upon supervised release, let's say no more than $50 a month, keep the probation officer advised about material changes in your economic circumstances, et cetera.
Perhaps
get us to exactly the same place?
Perhaps in some other case, yes. But in this particular case, Mr. Williams was an indigent, deemed as much by the court, deemed unable to pay a fine. Court's authority to impose a fine is dependent upon the defendant's ability
to pay one.
Of course he
may be indigent at the day of sentencing. But that doesn't mean he's not going to be able to earn some money in prison. He's probably going to be required to work. Employment's going to be a condition of supervised release. I guess I'm having trouble understanding what the point is here. Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm struggling to articulate it, even though I believe that there is a valid answer to your question. And I think it's more philosophical. The imposition of a fine is punitive. The fashioning of special conditions of supervised release is, according to Goodwin, supposed to be rehabilitative. So to impose, to sort of do a backdoor run around Goodwin in order to call the repayment of buy money a fine is to, let me try and get this right, it's to cloak punishment in the guise of rehabilitation or perhaps vice versa. But the two components of a criminal sentence serve different purposes, so that I'm not sure that they're lines that can just be blurred without distinction.
I thought Judge Hamblin was making a different point, that that supervised release could be an appropriate condition of supervised release and having a arguable rehabilitative purpose is to establish conditions that enable the defendant to discharge his sentence in full. So if he owes a lot for a fine, you can say, well, it'd be better that you pay something, so we'll impose some terms that you have no money now, but we don't want you to have the feeling that you beat the fine because you have no money, and so we'll impose some minimum obligation as part of your supervised release.
I think I understand your point, Your Honor, and it goes back to what I was attempting to explain to Judge Hamilton. If in the first instance the judge decides that an appropriate punitive component of the sentence shall be a fine, then to fashion the payment of that punitive fine over time as a condition of supervised release, properly explained, might suggest some rehabilitative component. In other words, you deserve punishment in the form of a $3,000 fine. To make you pay that $3,000 right now would be contrary to your greater well-being, your rehabilitation, and your reintegration into society. So, to help you along, sir, we're going to make the payment of that punitive fine a condition of your supervised release over intervals. That's taking the punishment and fashioning it in a rehabilitative way with an explanation.
I guess I'm questioning how sharp that distinction between punishment and rehabilitation is. In terms of, at least as a district judge, frankly, I approach this as saying, you know, in essence, part of your punishment and rehabilitation is the weekly or monthly reminder of your debt to society, you know, financial, after you've gotten out, while you're still reporting to probation and so on, that I want you as a defendant thinking about that obligation and remembering why you're paying it every month. Now, is that punishment? Is it rehabilitation? I'm not sure that's an either or.
And I don't want to split hairs, but I think that that's an important aspect of Goodwin's declaration.
I don't get it. So we penologists say that punishment, prison, fines, what have you, not capital punishment, though, has both general deterrence, you know, warns away other people, and specific deterrence. It reduces the likelihood of the defendant's repeating his criminal activities. That's rehabilitative by another name. So if the punishment is rehabilitative, including the fine, then trying to make it actually collectible is part of rehabilitation and appropriate, therefore, for supervised release.
And
then the question was, if you can do it, which was Judge Hamilton's original question, if you can do that for the fine, why can't you do it for the buy money, right? He put the government to an expense of the buy money, which has disappeared, not recovered, $1,200. So that's a cost he imposed. Why isn't it good for his soul, so to speak, that he should be required to make it good?
Your comments and questions, I think, have multiple layers. But I think something that's important to remember is that whether we're talking about a criminal fine or we're talking about restitution, there's an independent statutory basis that authorizes a judge to impose those financial sanctions. By money, there is no freestanding authority. Only by didato did we create this idea that you can't do it by restitution.
The release is just is completely open-ended, right?
It can't be completely open-ended, Judge. And in fact, the law says there are some boundaries.
Limitations on the special conditions that a judge can impose.
As I speculated about in my reply brief, I don't think a court could dictate that a defendant go to synagogue. I don't think that a judge could dictate that a defendant come to the judge's home on Saturday to wash the judge's personal vehicle.
But do you really think that repaying the buy money is similarly preposterous?
I think that it's counterproductive.
Why? Why is it counterproductive?
Because buy money was something that law enforcement chose.
Why is it counterproductive?
Because a defendant coming out of prison has statutory requirements to maintain employment, support his dependents, maintain a stable residence, and things of that nature. To the extent he's being forced to pay back the police, the money that the police chose to pay to him, that could put him sort of on the horns of a dilemma.
That's true of a fine or a restitution, right? Restitution is the same thing.
Well,
so you'd say restitution is counterproductive.
But at least it's statutorily authorized.
But you still think it's counterproductive.
It can be.
Well, you distinguish the fine, though. You say a fine is based on whether the ability to pay.
Correct.
Whereas you're thinking restitution has to have some other foundation. And I guess you would ask, well, why did he make me buy three guns instead of just one? That's one question, I guess.
But it is a curious anomaly in this particular case.
But the fact is, it totaled out to $1,200, so that's the set figure. It's not the same as a fine, which is going to be adjusted according to ability to pay. So I guess what you're saying is that if this is rehabilitation, it's okay. That's what he's going to get rehabbed, figuring out how to pay for it, I guess. Of course, he's going to be in prison for what period of time? 16 months?
16 months, I believe it is.
Yeah, so he's not going to be paying much of it back then. I don't know what you get paid in prison for a job. But
right.
Not very much.
I see my time is up.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mashek?
May it please the court. Bridget Demoshek appears on behalf of the appellee, the United States of America. Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, not only did the district court in this case clearly have the authority to impose the buy money repayment condition, the district court did not abuse its discretion in imposing this condition because, one, it clearly relates to the nature of the offense, two, it provides a deterrent effect, and three, it serves the rehabilitative goals of sentencing. I'd like to start by just quickly addressing one of the comments.
But where would you stop? I mean, so could the could supervised release include repaying the government's costs of prosecution?
The terms of supervised release are limited. It could in the right case. And by that I mean that the district court's authority to impose a term of supervised release is limited by statute, and by statute, it has to relate to the nature of the offense, the defendant's history and characteristics. It has to the extent that it's relevant.
Well, you're not answering my question. Suppose the government presents a bill to the court and says, look, we spent $100,000 prosecuting this person, and we think you should order us reimbursed. Is that permissible?
In this case?
No, not in this case. Is that ever permissible?
I think it can be permissible. That's not the case in front of this court, but for example...
I'm not asking about the case in front of it.
Yes,
I'm asking
it
the government spent $100,000 prosecuting someone, and it wants that reimbursed as a term of supervised release. And is that permissible?
Yes, I think under the law in the circuit it is permissible. For example...
No, there's never been a case like that, has there been?
Where the defendant fled to Canada and the court was authorized to impose a condition of supervised release requiring the defendant to pay for the costs that the agent spent apprehending that individual in Canada. And I believe the cost was about $3,600.
What case is that? Do you remember?
Give me just a minute.
But you cited it. Did you cite it?
I don't recall what case it is, Your Honor. I'm
you
happy
said
to
there was
submit a letter.
Okay.
Yes, there was, and I'm happy to follow up with a letter to the court. But to get back to Your Honor's question, would it ever be permissible for a district court to order a defendant to pay for the cost of the prosecution? For example, an amount of about $100,000. An amount that would, a case where that would typically come up would be, for example, in a wiretap investigation. If there were a number of individuals who are under investigation in a wiretap where I'm under the impression that the wiretap, each 30-day monitoring period, cost the government approximately $30,000. So you could extrapolate out.
That's a little excessive. You know, the Chinese, I don't know if they still do this, probably do, but, you know, they execute people by shooting them. And they used to, maybe they still are, they would then charge the cost of the bullet to the family of the executed person.
Well, I think that...
Ooh, what this sounds like, your position.
Well, I think that there's a difference between my position and the facts of this case. The question was whether the district court would ever be authorized to do that. And I think, given the right facts in the right case, yes. However, that's not the case here. Here, the government or the district court ordered the defendant to repay the cost of the controlled buys only. Conceivably, there were additional expenses that the agents incurred in investigating this individual. I don't know what they are, but I do know that it's undisputed that during these controlled transactions, the agents working with the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms ATF gave the defendant $400 during each firearms transaction, and Judge Adelman was well within his authority to order the defendant to repay that.
Is this routine in the Eastern District of Wisconsin?
I would say for the most part, yes, it is routine, yes.
And it's done with supervised release rather than fines?
Typically, yes, yes.
This is on drug transactions and other things that are common.
In a gun case, in a drug case, for example, yes, it's typical to have the district court order repayment of the buy money as a condition of supervised release.
Was there a reason for going? Were they looking for his source of getting guns? Is that why they did three instead of just one?
Well, there is a legitimate basis for doing three instead of one, which is the sentencing enhancement. And also, from an evidentiary perspective, certainly the case becomes stronger the more controlled buys were done. Now, this is not a case, for example, where, as Judge Posner posed the question, the law enforcement spent a tremendous amount of money, time, and resources investigating this individual. This was a relatively brief investigation. It took place.
That over makes a stronger case, of course.
Yes, and it took place over just a period of
no,
a couple
no,
months.
No, it makes the more they spend, the stronger the case for reimbursement.
Suppose the cost of investigation is $1 million. Not an everyday case, but it's certainly possible with some creative or detailed accounting, allocating overhead, et cetera, more than the fine that would be allowed. You're saying that could be ordered as part of supervised release?
Well, I think that in a case like that, hypothetically speaking, if that was imposed in lieu of a fine and potentially in lieu of imprisonment, that as long as the judge articulated the bases for doing so under 3553A, there would potentially be authority for a judge to do that. Yes, I think that it's clear under Section 3553A and Section 3583D that the district court is granted pretty wide discretion in imposing conditions of supervised release. I'd like to get back to the Dodato case. Attorney Stiller said that there is no freestanding authority to impose the repayment of buy money, and I think that Dodato is significant because it explained that ordering the repayment of buy money is sufficiently like restitution to make it fall under 3583D, and Dodato analyzed the restitution statute 3563 and said that it was akin to restitution even though there wasn't a formal victim. This circuit has repeatedly held that repayment of buy money is not considered restitution, and I'm not asking the court to do that here. I just think that the rationale of Dodato is important. And I also think that Dodato was important because this court has been invited previously to overrule Dodato and has declined to do so as recently as just a couple months ago in a case cited by the government. The court declined, in Goodwin, the court declined to follow Goodwin in Johnson, and Johnson was a case that the government cited under cover of a Rule 28 letter yesterday. You will recall in Goodwin, the defendant was convicted of failing to register as a sex offender, and this court vacated his sentence because the four special conditions, including ones limiting his contact with minors and possession of even legal sexually arousing material, bore no relationship to the offense of conviction for failing to register as a sex offender. Thereafter, in Johnson, this court again revisited the district court's authority to order the repayment of bail money as a condition of supervised release. And there, where the defendant was revoked, his supervised release was revoked after he was found in possession of marijuana and failing to report contact with law enforcement, among other offenses, this court affirmed the special condition requiring him to submit his person, residence, and electronic devices to searches by probation because the connection between the offense and the condition was obvious because many of his crimes were related to his possession of these contraband items. And the court went on to distinguish, Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I continue?
No, you got a minute.
Okay, thank you. The court went on to distinguish Johnson from Goodwin, saying that Goodwin's sentence was vacated because the conditions bore no obvious connection to his criminal conduct. And like Johnson, the present case is similarly distinguishable from Goodwin. The condition requiring the repayment of the $1,200 bail money is obviously related to the offense of conviction, and the district court was authorized to impose it. Unless there are any further questions, I will submit the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Damischer. Mr. Stiller?
Your Honor, I haven't consumed my 10 minutes.
Yes, I want to ask you. I want to ask you a question. What's the difference between paying back this buy money and doing community service?
Doing community service, in its traditional sense, is a way of making amends with and to the community you harmed.
Yes, I know, but you're not being paid for it, right?
You are not being paid for it.
Okay, so you're losing money. You could be working at a job that pays and say you have to do community service. So why is that different? Why is that essentially different from having to pay back your...
Because on more than theoretical terms, a person doing community service might learn a skill, might make a professional conduct that might facilitate employment. There's nothing about paying the police department back that serves any purpose.
Judges don't talk about that when they impose community service requirement. It's a way of teaching you a skill. Then it's no longer really community service. It's an investment in, you know, on-the-job training, right? Community service is supposed to be
a secondary benefit.
It's supposed to be serving the community. That's supposed to be good for you somehow.
Yes.
So why isn't paying back? There's a cost to you doing the community service. You don't want to do the community service.
The community didn't volunteer for my client's malfeasance. So when my client acted improperly in the community, his service to the community is a way of making amends. There's something rehabilitative about that.
The government for the fine money.
But the government, of course, took its taxpayer money and chose to devote it as it did. I think there's a difference.
It chose to. It has to. It has to enforce the law.
A sting is an effective law enforcement technique, but it's not a required one. Law enforcement chooses to employ that particular technique, effectively so and legally so.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Stiller. And you were appointed, so we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client. We also thank Ms. Damischer.